Markets looking up today. Euro bailout gives ideas to U.S. Federal Reserve. Bank buying becomes a Washington craze. Our coverage of the global financial...
capitalism's Katrina.
Post-greed syndrome.
The financial Titanic.
The Depression revisited.
Class warfare.
Idiots in charge.
Our coverage continues. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Monday, October 13th, Columbus Day. Adora Udoji is enjoying her holiday and we'll be back tomorrow. Today, we have a discussion of spiritual values in a time of incalculable wealth. Counties that count in Pennsylvania. A huge baseball weekend, but we begin with Europe to the rescue. That's right. The 15 leaders of the Euro countries have struck a deal. The plan includes guarantees for bank debt as well as government funds to keep key banks from failing. European markets are reacting positively to the news. Key indices across the continent are up by as much as 6%. Asian markets also gained. Hong Kong's Hang Seng led the way, up nearly 10%. American markets aren't open yet, but futures trading points to a really big opening. And Femi Okeh joins us for a look at other stories. What am I missing, Femi?
Hi there to you, John. Good morning. All three UK banks are taking $63 billion in British government money, and that's action on an unprecedented scale. But Prime Minister Gordon Brown said it had to be done.
In extraordinary times, with financial markets ceasing to work, the government cannot just leave people on their own to be buffeted about. For savers, for small businesses, and for homeowners, we must, in an uncertain and unstable world, be the rock of stability upon which British people can depend.
Now, the money didn't come without strings. Four top bank executives will leave, and hefty cash bonuses are out, and the UK will also pick up shares of the banks. Our partners at the New York Times report that the US government is offering protection to a massive Japanese bank investment in Morgan Stanley. Mitsubishi UFJ Financial was set to invest $9 billion in Morgan, but hesitated. Sources involved with the investment talks tell the Times that's when American Treasury officials stepped in to help. In Major League Baseball's playoffs, the LA Dodgers took a bite out of Philadelphia's National League Championship Series lead. The Dodgers won last night 7-2. The Phillies are up 2-1. Game 4 is tonight. And in the American League Championship, the Boston Red Sox and Tampa Bay Rays are tied 1-1. Game 3 is this afternoon, and we'll preview both games with a sports writer later on this hour.
John McCain is campaigning in Virginia and North Carolina. Barack Obama is in Ohio. Oil prices bounced back slightly to just above $80 a barrel in Asian trading. That's up from Friday's 13-month low. The Dow dropped 1.5% Friday to close at 84.51, but the futures show about a 3 or 4% rise at the open. So how would you rebrand the economic crisis? What would you call it instead of meltdown or crisis or whatever? We asked you last week to rebrand the crisis, and we've had hundreds and hundreds of responses. We want more. Also, some people are finding financial solace in the church and other spiritual institutions. How are you recalculating your values in light of the financial meltdown? Tell us your story at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. Values, financial and otherwise, on The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Star Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. And by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. Governments around the world are scrambling to come up with more ways to stem the continuing fallout over the credit crisis. The British government said this morning it is injecting $63 billion, a first installment, into banks in a bid to stave off their collapse. And a new Eurozone plan guarantees loans between banks and provides government capital to protect ailing financial institutions in return for taking an ownership stake in them. The ugly week that was is behind us, at least as far as the markets are concerned. But what is ahead as Europe and the UK proceed with plans to actually take control of the worldwide banking system? With the US expected to follow suit, this is a defining moment not only for this crisis, but also for the entire capitalist system itself. Joining us now is New York Times correspondent Mark Landler. He's in Washington, D.C. Mark, thanks for joining us.
Good morning.
So, I mean, is it too much to say this is a defining moment for global capitalism?
I don't think so. I think what you saw over the weekend was the first concerted global effort by governments to step in and try to put a stop to a situation that last week was totally out of control. And if you look at the early Asian stock trading and the stock futures in the U.S., the verdict is, at least so far, a good one. Investors feel that the policymakers are finally getting a grip on the problems, and while that doesn't say that there won't be very difficult times ahead, it at least suggests that what we had last week, which was that almost sickening feeling of no control, might be replaced by something a little more reassuring this week.
Well, reassurance is really the coin of the realm at this point. Neil Kashkari, an assistant treasury secretary who's running the TARP program, that's the U.S. Troubled Asset Recovery Program out of the U.S. Treasury on an interim basis, he's delivering a speech right now, and it's being carried live on a number of networks, probably the first time in history that an assistant treasury secretary received that kind of attention. Mark, explain to me the difference between regulation by a government over a bank if it's just a regulator and regulation by a government over a bank if it's also part owner of that bank?
Well, it's sort of relatively simple. A regulator has the right to tell a bank that it has to keep a certain ratio of capital on its books. That they call it a capital adequacy ratio and certain other very other basic things. They insure deposits. But if the government becomes a part owner, it can actually have a role in having control over the decisions the bank makes, the risks it takes, the management, the board, the dividend it pays, if any. So there are a wide range of things that the government, as a 40%, 50%, or 60% stakeholder in a bank, would control over the bank's affairs. Importantly, I should add, it will have very tight control over how the top executives are compensated, whether they get a golden parachute if they leave, whether they have to give back some of their compensation if the bank's condition later deteriorates. So there are a wide range of things that a government would do that it doesn't normally do.
And indeed, in the UK, as the British Treasury was injecting the $63 billion into three banks, at least one head of a bank was given the heave-ho.
So, absolutely, and that'll probably happen across the board in any bank recapitalizations. It's very hard politically to justify spending taxpayer money and leaving in the same guys who presumably had a role in getting the bank to that position.
Well, that raises the question, how come it is the case that leaders around the world are blaming U.S. financial mismanagement for causing this crisis, yet the only place where people appear to have any confidence in parking their money is U.S. Treasury bills? As the scale of the debacle becomes clear, the confidence in the U.S. government being able to manage this gets greater. I don't really understand that.
That's one of the great paradoxes of this whole situation. And it speaks to something interesting, which is that no matter how chaotic the U.S. situation looks and how difficult the situation is, the question is, what's the better bet? If you're not going to put your money in the U.S., what are your other alternatives? You can buy gold, of course, or you can put it in your mattress. But you're not necessarily going to put it into the Asian economies because you're not certain how the Asian economies are going to weather this period. And there's already a bad track record of financial instability in Asia. Until this morning, you probably wouldn't have put it anywhere near Europe. The Europeans have finally got their act together over the weekend, but last week the situation looked even more unsettled there. So it's not that it's necessarily an enormous vote of confidence in the U.S., but relative to any other option, the U.S. government still looks like a fairly good risk.
And the Dow Industrial Average futures are up something on the order of 370 points this morning. Is this just more volatility, an upward blip, or should we pay attention to this market open at 9:30?
Well, I'm not going to prognosticate about the market, and even my colleagues in New York who know much more about markets than I do make a point of saying you can't necessarily draw definitive conclusions from futures trading. There have been days where the futures have been trading up, and after a strong open, investors run out of steam in the middle of the session and the stocks turn down again. I mean, certainly it's better than if futures were trading down, and it does suggest that all the concerted action over the weekend seems to have had a psychological effect. The question is, as investors begin to focus on the cost of everything that was announced over the weekend and this morning, will they run out of enthusiasm? Because one of the grim realities is this is going to be very expensive.
Well, Mark Lando, New York Times correspondent, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
That on a day when Paul Krugman wins the Nobel Prize for Economics. Well, they're recalculating values of all kinds of things around the world in the midst of this financial crisis. But we thought we'd take a look at how people are recalculating their values in a otherwise than financial sense by talking with people who are very involved in a more spiritual process. And we're beginning with Reverend Dr. James Herbert Cooper. He's the rector of Trinity Church, located on Wall Street. Reverend Dr. James Herbert Cooper, thanks so much for joining us.
Good morning.
And I should say I'm a member of your parish. I should disclose that to the audience. I hope you won't berate me for not coming in yesterday. I was with my family. The question really I have for you, and Trinity Church has been tested twice on this. I mean, 9/11 was a test of spiritual values for both the community of Trinity Church and for people globally. This financial crisis, in a very different way, is also a recalculation of values. How are you dealing with that at the church?
Well, I think the analogy is good, John, that at 9/11, St. Paul's Chapel was a place of respite and care for people who were in the recovery process and rescue and recovery process. And in the same way, Trinity Wall Street, as it stands at the head of all Wall Street, is doing much the same thing, a place of respite, recovery, and then some specific programs to assist those who would choose to attend.
Well, before we talk about those specific programs, certainly the notion of wealth and poverty is a theme throughout Christian thought, and whether it's St. Francis insisting on the poverty of Christ or Joel Osteen insisting that God wants us all to be rich, religious leaders have been in this world quite a lot. How do you think this crisis creates a revisiting moment for that message for people like yourself?
Well, in our society, we talk about the redistribution of wealth, and in some ways this frightens us as to the redistribution of poverty, perhaps, in an upside-down, backwards sort of way. But caring people would look out for the dignity of all people and to look toward an equitable system of economics.
And in Trinity Church, you've had people from the Wall Street community. Your services are maybe more largely subscribed in the early hours of the morning than they have been in past months. Can you describe that?
Well, certainly the church is open all the time during the day, and the numbers increase at crisis points in our culture, society, economics, politics.
And you have particular programs where you're dealing, actually counseling people who have some issues, changing jobs and that sort of thing.
Right, using the resources of Psychotherapy and Spirituality Institute to provide programs on life in uncertain times and managing vocational or job transitions. Those two would be the current ones.
As someone who, you know, as the leader of a parish, how do you begin to see that this crisis is actually filtering down to the faces that are out there in the pews?
Well, both from those who have actually lost jobs at this point and perhaps the greater numbers of people who are anxious about the positions they currently now hold, that would be the main two groups.
And do you learn about that where people come to you personally, or is that something that sort of filters up from sort of word of mouth?
Both.
Well, it's a difficult task to ask for help, whether it's your minister or whoever it is. When we come back, I want to talk about how spiritual leaders and communities try to recreate wealth or refocus what people's notions of wealth are through cooperative efforts. The Reverend Dr. James Herbert Cooper, rector of Trinity Church in New York, is with us. We're talking about recalculating values in a time of financial stress. 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org is how you can reach us. We'll be right back.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. In the midst of all these financial headlines, we thought we'd take a look at people who are recalculating their value in a way different, maybe more complex than just looking at numbers on a bank statement. Maybe they're recalculating value in a more profound way. With us is the Reverend Dr. James Herbert Cooper, who's the rector of Trinity Church on Wall Street. Reverend Cooper, the church itself has actually had a central role, or at least has been a stage on which many enormously important financial transactions have taken place throughout American history. I mean, you haven't been there the whole time, of course. The church is 311 years old. But I'm wondering if this moment you feel called to some sort of responsibility here as a religious leader. Obviously, J.P. Morgan is going to show up and write a check to bail out the U.S. government, like what happened in 1906. But what do you think your role is here?
Well, I think our role is not to be the economic wizards of our time, but to be a place that convenes those perhaps who are, or a resource to those who are trying to put things back together, but perhaps more universally importantly to the average person who feels that this is a circumstance that is out of their control and is out of control, and they're looking for some place to begin a step of recapturing control of their own lives. Mm-hmm. In a very old church, the current building since 1846, sitting at the head of Wall Street, for those in that neighborhood is an iconic symbol of that hope.
Mm-hmm. You know, what we've discovered really in the last several weeks is that the system really is founded on a certain kind of faith and confidence that your money is there, when in fact, if everyone was to ask to withdraw it, it wouldn't add up. Faith is going to be a mechanism for restoring confidence in the banking system, and you know, faith is your business. How do you think the faith in a financial system mirrors or can maybe get lessons from spiritual faith?
Well, there's a lot of sharing of vocabulary between mm-hmm. the economic system and the spiritual system. It seems to be getting back to basics, honesty about who you are as an individual, to some reflection and occasionally redirecting the mm-hmm. way you do your life or do your work. So that's a beginning point for transition and change, is self-evaluation.
And in fact, so many of the financial institutions discover that when the sort of human person-to-person interaction gets out of the transaction, suddenly nobody knows what anything is worth, and the wealth evaporates. It sounds as though that's a lesson that perhaps spiritual institutions might use faith-to-face relationships as a way of rebuilding wealth, not simply rebuilding spiritual wealth, but actually rebuilding economic value.
Well, certainly the church primarily understands itself as people, not building, and so getting back into relationships and values of relationship is a key, I would assume, in business as well.
Now, the Trinity Church has a very interesting situation in that because of Queen Anne, you know, hundreds of years ago, a bequest was given to this church that makes it very wealthy outside of, you know, donations that are given by parishioners. How does that wealth empower you or become in some ways marching orders for you to reinvigorate a community?
Well, certainly, again, to be responsible investors in the community, the city of New York, but Trinity Church also has worldwide, global, just like the banks, that we're not just on an island here. We're on an island, a wonderful international city, but connections all over the world as well. And it's the relationships that we would focus on, and our resources would be direct. The stockholders for us are the needs of the world. And so the income that comes from our investments serve that purpose.
And have you learned anything about the financial system in your own sort of kind of statements there in the back offices of the church?
Well, like every family who has the joy of having some portfolio of some sort, ours is to try and have diversity amongst real estate and other investments, and hopefully one balances out the other in periods like this.
What is the wealth of a community, as you see when you're sitting out there delivering a sermon on Sunday? What is the wealth that's represented as you see it when you look at those faces and those people?
It's the diversity of people, all walks of life, all backgrounds and traditions that come together. It's the coming together that has the power and magnitude to transform.
And how do you tell people that by working together, one can rebuild the wealth that might have been lost in numerical terms in bank statements and you know, get beyond this crisis?
Well, I'm not sure that as a theologian I have the specific answer other than helping people restore confidence in their own ability to live life and to be blessed by God. You know, I think the idea that all things always work out is not the basic theological doctrine. The basic theological doctrine is that God will be with us, whether it's in 9/11 or a hurricane or an economic crisis, that's the primary promise. And then out of that promise, by faith, we take some steps forward to rebuild and come off the ark and plant the stuff again and get going.
Oh, thank you. That's a great thought. The Reverend Dr. James Herbert Cooper, rector of Trinity Church on Wall Street, is with us all hour. And we're talking about reformulating spiritual values in light of a financial catastrophe. How are you doing at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org? Also, do you have a different name for this financial crisis? You can call us, 877-8-MY-TAKE. We've been getting hundreds of responses. And now, Femi Okay with the headlines.
Thanks, John. It is coming up to 28 minutes past the hour. Asian markets welcome news of efforts by European nations to provide protection for their banks. Hong Kong's major index closed up 10%. European investors followed suit. The FTSE is up about 4%. Meanwhile, investors on Wall Street appear to be thinking that what goes down must come back up. Dow futures are up around about 5%. The Bush administration says it's working out how to buy $700 billion worth of bad debt. They announced today that they're consulting with law firms on how the government will take ownership in banks. Fire officials are preparing for rapid growth of a wildfire in Southern California. The fire is only smoldering at the moment, but officials fear that powerful Santa Ana winds will cause it to spread. The fire has burned more than 2,000 acres so far. 15 people are dead in Pakistan after a skirmish near the Afghan border early this morning. Violence has increased in the northwest of Pakistan in recent weeks. The government is encouraging tribes in the region to take up arms against the Taliban and Al-Qaeda militants. Iraq's prime minister says he doesn't need British troops in southern Iraq. There are currently 4,100 there. Nouri al-Maliki said that a few could stay for training and technical support, but combat troops aren't necessary. And finally, the American Academy of Pediatrics is urging children to double the recommended amount of vitamin D.
Thank you.
The recommendation comes from new research suggesting that the vitamin reduces the risk for cancer, diabetes and heart disease. And most children will have to take a supplement to keep up or drink 4 cups of vitamin D fortified milk each day.
Thank you for me. And I'm glad you say indices. I think that's good.
Is that good?
That's really good.
Did
it's better
that?
Than indexes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right.
Thank you.
Very
thank
good.
You, Femi.
You're very welcome.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home, auto, and life insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
If we can pull a big vote out of Northeast Eastern Pennsylvania for Barack and Joe. There isn't any way they lose Pennsylvania. And if they win Pennsylvania, there's no way they lose the White House.
Listen to that. All is forgiven. Hillary Clinton on a first-name basis with Barack and Joe, making her first campaign appearance in Pennsylvania yesterday on behalf of the Obama campaign. All eyes are on Pennsylvania this week. Obama, Biden, McCain, and Palin are making campaign stops there. Latest polls are turning in Obama's favor, but Takeaway political director Andrea Bernstein is finding a lot of undecided voters in another of our Counties That Count series. Andrea is in Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania right now. Good morning, Andrea.
Good morning, John.
Well, you're not going to convince me that there are undecided voters at a Clinton rally for Barack Obama, are you?
No, but there are some in the area. I mean, I'm in the Wyoming Valley in Lucerne County, sort of in the foothills of the Poconos. And Wilkes-Barre and Scranton, which is just over the county line, are sort of these old coal cities, these places in America that once were something and want to be something again. And this is one of the areas in the country where Hillary Clinton pulled in some of her biggest margins, 3-1. So yesterday when she came out onto the stage, there was this very sustained applause. And, you know, remember in the primary when she was arguing, well, you know, the hardworking Americans in the swing states, they're all for me. Now it's her job to convince many of them. And when I was here just a few weeks ago, the sort of racial issue was very close to the surface. So she came out on the stage and she practically took it head on.
I know you've got friends and neighbors and maybe even some family members who aren't decided yet. You might even have a few lean in the wrong direction. Barack and Joe are not asking you to marry them. They're asking you to vote for them and vote for yourselves.
So she just puts on that twang and then everybody goes, sure, I'll vote for him. Come on.
Well, you know, it's interesting because even yesterday I was finding people that have only decided in the last week, they say they're Democrats, but they've only just decided since the debate began to vote for Hillary Clinton, or someone that I met out in the parking lot, and they're all wearing these big brown buttons that say Hillary sent me, Belinda Madden. She's unemployed, and she said that it took her a long time to come around to Obama.
I was a Hillary person. I was for Hillary. And Obama's okay, but Joe Biden solidified that for me.
What? What is it about Joe Biden that solidified it for you?
Because he's like the rest of us. He makes mistakes. He came home when his wife was in the hospital. He used to make the trip. He didn't stay in D.C.
You know, I don't see how that motivates you to vote for a campaign, but it's fascinating to hear those voters agonizing about their decision.
Right. And, you know I was at a rally, so, and I had to eat, so I went over to the St. Stanislaus Polish National Catholic Elementary School annual Polish food festival.
Of course you did.
And, I mean, that's a really key ethnic group in this area, Polish, Catholic, Democrat, but very, very conservative in their voting patterns. And there were a lot of people there, including a woman who said to me, I am not voting. I was a Hillary Clinton voter. Now she's out of it, and I am sitting this one out. And she had actually just met Bill Clinton that day. But there were also some other people in this voting hall. Now, this is white Catholic, so this is McCain's group. His name was Ray Mikowski. He was in the mail order business. And he and I had a long, thoughtful conversation, and he said, you know, I have been a lifelong Republican, but the country's in such a mess, I don't want to vote Republican right now. But he wasn't quite ready to vote for Obama either.
I mean, I think a lot of people feel this way, is his name sounds like a Middle Eastern, you know, and is he a sleeper cell? A lot of people be thinking, you know, it's like, you don't know. You know, they pump all this fear into you about sleeper cells and all of this, just waiting to get into power, waiting to act. You know, it's scary, but I don't think he is. But I think a lot of people feel that way, you know. It's like, it sounds like an Iraqi name or something, you know.
Despite that?
I think he's got a lot of good ideas. I really do. I think he's a worthwhile candidate. And I think if he had a little more experience, I'd be on his boat.
Man, that is interesting stuff. I mean, how widely do you think people are thinking that?
Well, you know, I think that some people are. And I think that, you know, he was a completely, you know, sort of thoughtful person. In fact, we're going to be posting our whole interview on the takeaway.org in just a little bit, and people can hear the whole thing if they want. But that is what the McCain campaign is looking for, not necessarily the, you know, yahoos who are yelling out racial epithets at his rallies, but people who are trying to think this thing through, who are like Ray Mikowski and who are sort of feeling, you know, this concern. And he, you know, he said it. He said they're pumping us full of fear. And, you know, that is what the last, in particular, last week of this campaign has been about. That is who the McCain campaign is trying to get in these waning weeks.
And we should point out that, you know, you're doing substantive interviews with all these people. You're not sort of going for sound bites here. These are thoughts and thought processes that come out after getting to know you and spending some time talking to you. This isn't just stuff they're shouting like they would shout at a rally.
No, I mean, this was not somebody who was full of hate. And, you know, as a matter of fact, I mean, he liked things about Obama and was really puzzling it through. And he had voted for Mike Huckabee in the primary. So, you know, this is a very conservative sort of pro-life area. And the fact that there are people even thinking of about Obama, these Republicans, even while there are the sort of Hillary Clinton voters that are sort of, you know, some of the hardest to get Democrats in America for Obama. It's a real interesting mix in northeastern Pennsylvania. And that's why they're all here. Sarah Palin's coming tomorrow.
All right, Andrea, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Andrea Bernstein, Takeaway's political director in Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania, part of her Counties That Count series. You can find all the counties that count on our website at thetakeaway.org. And now with the Columbus Day headlines, we have Femi Okay.
Thanks, John. Just coming up to 20 minutes to the top of the hour. Iceland was supposed to open its markets for trading again today, but it's decided to keep them closed another day. That's after an historic week in which the Icelandic government stepped in to take control over the country's three banks. Here in the US, the Federal Reserve has approved a $12 billion takeover of the ailing bank Wachovia by Wells Fargo. This comes after a week-long battle over Wachovia with Citigroup. Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki says that British troops are no longer needed in the southern part of the country to provide security. He expressed disappointment with the British performance during last spring's fighting in the southern city of Basra. The first bidding for energy contracts in Iraq since the 2003 invasion begins today in London. Iraq is believed to have more than 115 billion barrels of untapped oil. South Korea says it may expand cooperation with North Korea now that the US has removed Pyongyang from a terrorism blacklist. But the decision also incensed some activists who took to the streets in Seoul and even tried to burn signs with photos of North Korean leader Kim Jong-il. It's 22 days until Election Day, so let me get you up to date with who's on the campaign trail today. John McCain is in Virginia and North Carolina. Barack Obama is in Ohio. And John McCain has just said this morning, "The national media has written us off. Senator Obama is measuring the drapes. My friends, we've got them just where we want them." End of quote.
Thank you very much, Femi.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
Down the right field line. This ball, big trouble, and it stays in play. Three runs are going to score. The rookie delivers. It's 5-0.
And it went on to be a slugfest there in Los Angeles as the Los Angeles Dodgers win one from the Philadelphia Phillies, who had a 2-0 advantage going into the baseball weekend. And it was a big baseball weekend. The Tampa Bay Rays topped the Boston Red Sox in an 11-inning nail-biter. And the Dodgers, of course, as we just mentioned, beat the Phillies. So Sarah Bunting joins us. She's a sports writer and writer of the blog TomatoNation.com. Pretty exciting weekend.
Yeah, very exciting.
Let's talk about the Red Sox and Rays. For my taste, it was great to see the Rays come alive.
Me too. And that's really been the narrative throughout the season, is people kind of expecting the team to return to some sort of mean, which in the case of the Rays is not being very good. So, there's been a lot of talk about their relative inexperience, whether they can step up against Boston. So it was good, especially in 11 innings.
All right, and they're a scrappy young team, and people like really are thrilled to have them even be in the postseason. And, you know, the Boston Red Sox have gone from, it seems like, counting themselves out against the Angels to feeling like, hey, they can make it all the way. What do you sense the morale of the Red Sox is at this point?
I think the Red Sox at this point, they have excellent morale compared to 2 years ago, 5 years ago. It's a completely different experience for both the fans and the team that I think they're very confident that even with the occasional injuries, like Mike Lowell is out for this series, and he was the World Series MVP last year. And I think that it's critical for their success that they're able to sort of close the gaps in their game when they need to.
And they do. I mean, they have hits all over that lineup.
Yeah.
Pedroia was amazing.
Well, and that guy, you know, he had not had a good postseason to date, but that guy is a very tough out. You're looking at a possible MVP for him, and that entire lineup is relentless, I think is the word they used on the broadcast.
So Joe Torre and Manny Ramirez are going to make New York love the Dodgers, I think. What do you think?
I think there's still a lot of good feeling about Torre. And after the, you know, I'm a Yankee fan, full disclosure, and after the season that we had, that wasn't anyone's fault. But I think there is still a lot of fondness for Torre and how many times he brought the team to the postseason. Manny, I don't know. It's not dull. It's not boring to watch that guy.
They cleared the bench in the game last night.
Oh,
it almost was a fight. Jim Cooper from Trinity Church, I see you shaking your head here. You a baseball fan? You with the Dodgers?
Yankee fan.
So are you rooting for the Dodgers?
Well, actually, I am, because that's what makes great rivalry. I'm rooting for the Red Sox and the Dodgers because they're the great rivals of the Yankees.
That will be the narrative if it's Red Sox-Dodgers with Manny Ramirez facing his old team.
Absolutely, and then Joe Torre back in that seat against the Red Sox and against Francona.
You want to call it?
Who's going to the World Series or who would win that matchup? I think the Phillies are going.
You think the Phillies? Phillies looked really strong.
Yeah, they do. And that sort of mini narrative in that championship series is that these teams have been playing each other all year and nobody's winning on the road.
Mm-hmm.
Regardless of where they're playing.
And the Phillies have a four-game advantage since they get four games at home. The Dodgers will only get three games at home. So if that proves true, the Phillies are going to be winning. Sarah Bunting, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having
me. Sarah Bunting is a sports writer and writer of the blog TomatoNation.com. And, man, no rotten tomatoes, lots of baseball. Thanks, Sarah.
Thanks.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
And now another installment in our exclusive series, Headlines from Femi Okeh.
Thanks, John. 12 minutes to the top of the hour. The Treasury Department says it's moving to get the $700 billion rescue program going quickly. It announced a team of managers and an oversight board today. Neil Kashkari is the Assistant Treasury Secretary and he's the interim head of the program.
This is Secretary Paulson's highest priority, and we are committed to working around the clock to making it happen. We are also committed to helping homeowners stay in their homes and using the taxpayers' money efficiently.
And he looks like Dr. Evil.
Actually, I thought you looked quite cute in a sort of Treasury interim secretary kind of way.
Okay.
Yes, Mr. Bond, I expect you to die. Why are you derailing the news this morning? What is wrong with you?
I don't know.
Let me continue. Neil Kashkari spoke about 50 minutes or so ago. He said that officials were developing the guidelines that will govern the purchase of bad assets and was consulting with six specialist law firms on how the government will take partial ownership of banks. Governments across Europe are making new moves to jumpstart the credit market and prop up banks. So far today, the markets like the moves. European markets are up between 4 and 7% and key indices closed higher across Asia. In great economic turmoil, today's Nobel Prize announcement is getting extra attention. The prize for economics went to the American Paul Krugman. He's the New York Times columnist and Princeton professor, and he won for his work on global trade. With Zimbabwe's power-sharing deal near collapse, former South African President Thabo Mbeki is headed to Harare for emergency talks. Longtime President Robert Mugabe said that he will give all key ministries to members of his party, and that has opposition leader Morgan Tsvangirai threatening to pour out. And a sleeping giant, that's what Los Angeles area firefighters call the wildfire north of the city. The flames mostly died down last night, but firefighters are worried that high winds will wake up the inferno. That's a look at some of the main stories making news this morning. John.
Thank you, Femi. So we're talking about the economic crisis, and we've been asking for you to rebrand it in some way. What would you call this meltdown instead of meltdown?
My name is Shirley Koshy. And I call this fiasco ambition gone wrong, financial diarrhea.
All Shirley did was call 877-8-MY-TAKE and leave her suggestion, or you can weigh in at mytake@thetakeaway.org. And you can vote on new names for the economy on our website at thetakeaway.org. Or you vote on suggestions from other listeners. There's an interesting top three. You can go there right now. Joining us now are Randall Balmer, professor of American religious history at Barnard College, Columbia University, and author of God in the White House, How Faith Shaped the Presidency from John F. Kennedy to George W. Bush. Also with us is the Reverend Dr. James Herbert Cooper, rector of Trinity Church on Wall Street in New York. We're talking about the campaign, and we're also talking about the financial crisis as it relates to spiritual values. And evangelicals have been, have held an important role in American politics for the last several cycles, and they've been associated with organizational strength of the Republican base, I think it's fair to say, but I suspect that is changing this year. We're hearing from a lot of voices and a lot of denominations expressing political passions in the campaign. Randall, what are you noticing?
Well, first of all, I want to take a slight exception to your opening comment here. I think evangelicals have historically been, in fact, associated with those on the margins of society, particularly in the 19th century. And the aberration, in my judgment, is the rise of the religious right beginning in the late 1970s that, you're quite right, co-opted a lot of evangelical voters.
You know, it seems that in our time, or at least in this campaign, the idea of being an evangelical, whether it be for environmental reasons or because of pro-life and pro-choice positions, is a much more mainstream position. You say evangelical position started on the fringe, but even beyond the Republican base, it seems to be a much more broadly mainstream movement in America today.
I think it is. And what happened in the 20th century is that evangelicals were largely quiescent for really the middle decades of the 20th century, roughly from the Scopes trial of 1925 till Jimmy Carter's campaign in the mid-70s. And then they began to reemerge into public consciousness as well as a political force. My argument has always been that the religious right has been now to the Republican Party what the labor unions once were for the Democratic Party. That is the kind of the spine, the backbone of the entire party.
But the evangelical experience, the born-again experience, is a very personal one. And young people who are having this experience, you know, maybe have an evangelical moment and then they have a political moment. How are young people finding politics when they take their religion and suddenly decide whether they're going to choose a candidate one way or another?
Well, I think the pressure from their peers, from the older generation, is to be single-issue voters with issues of abortion and same-sex unions.
And young people aren't down for that, right?
No, they're not. And what I'm finding more and more is that there's a generation gap between these the old-line leaders, people like James Dobson and Chuck Colson, and the younger generation. And the younger generation has no interest in issues of sexual identity. It just doesn't register with them. If you press them, they'll say, well, yes, I'm pro-life. I'm against abortion. But I think even that issue is beginning to fade in importance. And they do recognize, for example, that the issue of global warming is a real issue, unlike people like Dobson and others who insist that it's not.
Jim, are young mainline passionately religious parishioners in a church like the Episcopal Church evangelical in any sense?
Certainly in a direct personal relationship with God and celebrating that with one another, but it moves quickly to wanting to do something significant in the world, good works of some sort. In fact, I think it may even begin with that, and then they find the spiritual experience.
You know, we've talked all hour about this notion of good works and community involvement. Does that favor one party or another, Randall?
Probably not. I think that, again, among evangelical voters, there's a a broadening of the agenda for toward issues such as AIDS and hunger and poor relief, away from the single issue that the older generation has insisted is the most important issue. And I think the abortion issue is fading in part because these younger evangelicals recognize that there's no real passion behind it in terms of a political will. By my calculation, from February 1st, 2006, when Samuel Alito was sworn onto the Supreme Court, mm-hmm. until January 3rd, 2007, when the new Democratic majorities took control of Congress, this Republican religious right organization controlled all three branches of the federal government. The chief executive, the majority leader of the Senate, and the Speaker of House of Representatives all claimed to be evangelical Christians, unalterably opposed to abortion. They made no effort whatsoever to outlaw abortion.
It is amazing how little was accomplished given that penetration of the government. So would you call the transformation that's taking place now a sort of restoration of the status quo ante from the 70s, or is it something fundamentally new?
I think it is fundamentally new, and I don't think we're there yet. But as somebody who is both an evangelical Christian as well as an Episcopal priest, it is for me important that evangelicals reclaim their heritage, not only in the teachings of Jesus, and Jesus expressed a great deal of concern for those on the margins of society, but also what I consider to be the noble legacy of 19th century evangelical activism that unfailingly took the part of those who were marginalized, those who were less advantaged.
And do you think, Jim Cooper, the mainline churches like the Episcopal churches can have a leadership role in something like that?
I think they have both a leadership and followership. The culture has changed and shifted, and we're affected by that. But
the numbers are daunting, yeah, for mainline churches. What do you think your role is in this? I mean, actually, let me ask you this. You know, a lot of ministers decided to step up in the pulpit and endorse a candidate specifically challenging the tax-exempt status. Were you tempted to do something like that, and what's your position?
Only in attempting to challenge the tax-exempt status. I think I wouldn't be on preaching a candidate from the pulpit, but rather issues anyway.
Reverend James Cooper, rector of Trinity Church on Wall Street in New York. Also with us was Randall Balmer, professor of American Religious History at Barnard College, Columbia University, and author of God in the White House, How Faith Shaped the Presidency from John F. Kennedy to George W. Bush, the changing role of evangelicals in this 2008 campaign. We're always on at The Takeaway, of course. All hour we've been asking what your word for the economic crisis is, and we get answers.
Hello, this is Rob Martin in Buffalo Valley, Oklahoma, and my idea is Nightmare on Wall Street. Why don't we call it economic shock and all?
Tell us your word or words for the economic crisis at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org, and hopefully you'll find some financial solace in this prediction.
What we had last week, which was that almost sickening feeling of no control, might be replaced by something a little more reassuring this week.
Well, the markets seem reassured. In about 30 minutes, they open. But that's your takeaway from Mark Landler, New York Times correspondent. And in addition to the economy, we're following the campaign, of course, on our election website. Vote 2008.thetakeaway.org. You'll find tools for tracking the candidates and posts from bloggers watching the campaigns from abroad. Also, look for America's exit poll from people who've actually been doing early voting. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
So, another holiday weekend. Let's check the phone messages, huh?
Hi, I'm Marco from Oklahoma City, and this is how I refer to the present financial crisis.
Marco, dude, is he laughing or crying? We may have a winner. We asked for new names for this financial madness, and America responded. When you don't know whether to laugh or cry, it's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Monday, October 13th. Adora Udoji is enjoying this Columbus Day and will be back tomorrow. It's been a busy weekend for automakers trying to survive a stock meltdown. As industry's real local politicians Bob and Wee, we're going to have a look at Republican challenges in congressional races. Also, War Room Redux and Franken, or is it Frankenstein, who's stalking Lake Wobegon? Those stories coming up, but first we have some headlines. The Treasury Department talked up progress in getting the $700 billion rescue plan started. This in a bid to reassure investors as American markets prepare to open. Assistant Treasury Secretary Neil Kashkari runs the program.
We are moving quickly but methodically, and I am confident we are building the foundation for a strong, decisive, and effective program.
He's the $700 billion man, and right now the rescue package team is working on guidelines to buy bad assets as well as the tricky legal details in taking partial bank ownership. European leaders are putting in new measures of their own. The leaders of the Eurozone countries have struck a deal to guarantee bank debt and keep financial institutions healthy, and European markets are reacting positively to the news. Femi Okay now joins us for a look at some other stories. What am I missing, Femi?
Hello there, John. Iraq's prime minister says that his country doesn't need British troops in southern Iraq. There are currently 4,100 there. Nuri al-Maliki said a few could stay for training and technical support, but combat troops aren't necessary. In Major League Baseball's playoffs, the LA Dodgers took a bite out of Philadelphia's National League Championship Series lead. The Dodgers won last night 7-2. The Phillies are up 2-1. Game 4 is tonight. In the American League Championship, the Boston Red Sox and the Tampa Bay Rays are tied 1-1. Game 3 this afternoon.
You have a preference?
Oh, goodness.
Who are you rooting for?
Let me go for the Red Sox.
Let me go for the Red Sox. She picks it randomly out of a
hat. No. I'm very close to Boston. I love Boston.
All right. Yeah. There we go. John McCain is in Virginia and North Carolina. Barack Obama is in Ohio. And keep your responses coming about what you would call this economic crisis if you could rebrand the whole thing.
I would call the current situation American Dream Recalibration.
Tell us your new name for financial meltdown at 1-877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTAKE at thetakeaway.org. Markets on Wall Street are going to open a little less than a half hour from now, and they're expected to open positively. So maybe you'll have some happy words for our financial meltdown at 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTAKE at thetakeaway.org. One other thing on a more serious note. We're taking a look at people who are recalculating their notion of values in the midst of this financial crisis. When the numbers don't mean much, how do you calculate value in your life? A spiritual approach to this financial crisis. Tell us your story at 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTAKE at thetakeaway.org. Red Sox fan, huh?
Yeah.
I would never have figured.
Go Red Sox. Red Sox.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Star Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. And by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. So beside the bank bailout plotline, over the weekend there was also this. GM stock lost an enormous amount last week, and then there were talks of a Chrysler-GM merger. There were even reports of a GM-Ford merger, but industry analysts are baffled. Two struggling automakers, the nation's first and third largest, they share common problems. It's totally unclear how their coming together could help either of them. Rebecca Lindland is director of industry research for the automotive group of the consulting company Global Insight. She's our guide to the complexities of the auto industry, particularly at this unprecedented and very troubling moment. Rebecca, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me on, John. I hope we don't get too lost in this, though.
Well, let's start at the beginning. GM stock tanks last week, and all of a sudden, Standard & Poor's downgrades the company. The word on the street is it's unclear whether GM can survive its cash crunch. And then all of a sudden, over the weekend, we hear that GM maybe had an overture to Ford for a merger and was in some sort of talk with Chrysler or the owner of Chrysler, Cerberus.
Well, you know what? I think that this is a really good example of there, you just can't leave anything on the table during these kinds of economic crisis times. I mean, we are looking, you know, at unprecedentedly low levels of stock from Ford and from GM. And of course, Chrysler's privately held now. Everything is on the table. The problem with that, though, is that then you've got to stop and really start digging deep for obvious synergies. And they aren't obvious. In fact, I think that any kind of merger, while it would certainly produce billions in cost savings, those cost savings would be years off and really would be could be harshly offset by legal bills in terms of getting out of, say, dealer consolidation agreements and such.
Or even dwarfed by the liabilities both companies have. I mean, if there are any synergies here, it's that the companies have these pension liabilities and other kinds of liabilities.
Well, the one positive about the pension liability is that in 2010, they have an agreement with the UAW that pushes those liabilities off of their books. So that's one of the reasons why oftentimes you may hear, oh, 2010 is kind of the big savior time of these companies, that because they get to put off tens of billions of dollars. The problem, though, is getting to 2010 right now. Right now, it's getting through 2008.
Right, exactly. It's getting through October right now, yeah. So, Rebecca, let's talk about this. Maybe the driver here is Cerberus, not so much GM, in that Cerberus may be hemorrhaging from both ends and is looking for some way of getting Chrysler out from under its books.
It definitely could be looking at that. I mean, Cerberus has two big problems on their books. And the first is GMAC, which is General Motors Acceptance Corporation, which is the financing arm of GM, which Cerberus bought 51% of in 2006 because GM needed to raise cash. At the time, we were all very concerned about that, but the reality was that it turned out to be a really good move because Cerberus now has lost half of the investment it made in GMAC because GMAC went into the subprime mortgage. So we have that issue to contend with, and then Cerberus also, of course, bought Chrysler. So they really need to see about dumping something. But you don't want to dump a really sick company onto a company that's already in ICU like GM is.
Well, let's talk about GMAC for a moment, General Motors Acceptance Corporation. At one time, that was the biggest asset that GM has.
Oh, and I will not lie to you. When they came and said they were going to be liquidating that or selling half of it, we were like, wait a minute, that's where your cash is coming from. But then it turns out, because of the subprime crisis, it actually was a really, really good thing that they did because they're only taking half the hit. So they're only losing billions as opposed to, you know, tens of billions of dollars off of it.
Rebecca, last question. I mean, one of the ironies, and maybe it's the tragedy of this whole thing, is that with oil prices plummeting now under $80 a barrel, the auto industry is not able to take advantage of these fuel economies by selling more cars because people can't get loans. I mean, they just sit and watch these oil prices drop and they can't do anything about it.
They can't. And normally, what we estimate that if oil goes up or down $10 a barrel, it usually puts about 200,000 new vehicles into sales every year. So if our forecast is 16, it would go to 16.2 if we can get oil lower. In this case, we can't increase the forecast because there are so many other bad factors in the economy, like consumer confidence and the inability to borrow any money.
Wow. Rebecca Lindland, Director of Industry Research, the Automotive Group of Global Insight. Thanks, as always, for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me on again, John.
Sure. Well, we're talking about the auto industry and how it is creaking in places like Detroit and other places around the United States. With markets in so much turmoil, economic issues have landed smack in the middle of congressional races all across the country. Joining us on the line now is Congressman Tom Cole, Republican from Oklahoma, is chairman of the National Republican Congressional Committee, which is a political committee devoted to increasing the number of Republicans in Congress. He certainly has his fingers on the pulse of congressional races around the country. Tom Cole, thanks for joining us.
You bet, John.
So, Congressman, let's take the auto example for a minute. How is the teetering auto industry affecting congressional races in places like Detroit or even farther south in the non-union auto zone of like Kentucky and Tennessee?
Well, certainly in the northern states, it's hurting quite a bit. And you know, a bad economy, the perception of one, I think, tends to help, you know, it tends to help Senator Obama, tends to help Democrats broadly. Strangely enough, in other parts of the country, it's a little bit less of a problem simply because so much of the auto industry that is non-American, honestly, is doing pretty well. And so when you move into the Kentuckys and the Alabamas, places like that that have pretty substantial auto presence now, those factories are turning out cars, doing well, and actually I think you'll see, strangely enough, McCain do pretty well in those kind of regions. So but it's a very nuanced pattern. But overall, the economy helps the Democrats.
But it's not as though in those states where foreign automakers are building in American districts, it's not a case that the economy favors the Republicans. It's just the fact that it's a non-issue favors Republicans.
Yeah, I think that's fair enough.
Right. Well, let's talk about North Carolina. North Carolina is certainly a Republican stronghold, whether you're talking about electoral votes for president or, say, race for senator. The Wachovia situation is right smack dab in the middle of North Carolina. It's been acquired by Wells Fargo. The banking crisis is all over North Carolina. How does that affect races that you're watching?
Well, North Carolina is pretty competitive at the presidential and senatorial level right now, but frankly, we don't see much competition congressionally. The Democrats that are in Democratic districts are in pretty safe condition. Same's true of the Republicans, but you know, broadly speaking, in North Carolina, much more competitive than normal, but it just hasn't reached into the districts. The districts, given reapportionment, are pretty strongly aligned toward one party or the other. So it's just not that critical a congressional battlefield this year.
Seems to me you have an interesting challenge. I mean, John McCain has already said, I am not George W. Bush. And he said that at the debates, and he's sort of signaled through his surrogates that that's a mission that he has to accomplish at the upcoming debate on Wednesday. John Sununu, in trying to describe himself as separate from George Bush, claims that he votes with New Hampshire, that he's not a Republican or a Democrat. He's voting 100% for New Hampshire. How do you design messages for congressional candidates who have to distance themselves from the incumbent president?
Well, you know, it's interesting for us because we don't think of the world state by state or region by region. We think of it district by district. And there's certainly broad stretches of the country where the president's not popular. And candidates need to take that into account. Usually, though, congressional candidates know their electorate with more intimacy than senators, let alone presidential candidates. You literally can reach most of the people in a very direct way.
So is it easier for a congressional candidate to distance themselves from a president than, say,
a
senator?
It's easier for them to develop their own identity. You know, now you've got to have enough money to break through. Again, a lot of it depends on your media market. If you're in a relatively, you know, easy district in terms of one media market, that's great. But if you're one member in Los Angeles where there's multiple districts and you can't afford television, or if you've got multiple media markets because your district sprawls, your problem becomes different. So it's a technical problem. But, you know, there's parts of the country where the president's very popular. You know, if you're running in Houston, Texas, in which there's a very competitive race down there, you don't need to distance yourself from the president. If you're running in Alabama where there's two open seats, one Republican, one Democrat, you know, the president of the United States visiting would be a great advantage.
Well, Representative Cole, we'll talk with you more after this check of the news, and particularly I want to know whether a vote either for or against the bailout helps Republicans in tough districts. Oklahoma Representative Tom Cole is joining us. He's also the chairman of the National Republican Congressional Committee, talking about tight races around the country.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age. Everybody has their own opinion, discussions, and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. And, of course, we're talking about the economic whatchamacallit.
The name that I give to our financial situation is greed gone wild.
We want to look at his cable subscription, don't we? We want your responses coming about how you would rebrand the economic crisis. What would you call it instead? Give your name at 877-8MYTAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. You can also submit your ideas at thetakeaway.org and vote on suggestions from other listeners. Right now, the number one is the age of economic reality. Kind of a sober suggestion there. Oklahoma Representative Tom Cole is still with us. He's the chairman of the National Republican Congressional Committee. Congressman Cole, in light of all this economic news, if you voted for the bailout or rescue or whatever you want to call it, is that good for you as a Republican congressman or bad for you in the election?
Speaking as somebody who did vote for what I'll call the rescue plan, it was a tough vote. The calls in our district ran overwhelmingly against it, and I don't know of any member, Republican or Democrat, whose calls were not negative. On the other hand, I think it's a conscience vote, and I think you get points over the long term for people seeing you do the tough thing. Particularly if this works out, looks a little bit better this morning than it did last Monday morning. People like to see decisive action at a time of crisis. And so at the end of the day, I think you just vote what you believe and you can go home and argue it either way and usually do pretty well. But there's no question voting for this was not a popular thing to do in any district in America that I'm aware of.
Well, you took a principled stand on the rescue, but were there any districts or are there any districts where a double no vote was absolutely essential for the Republican to retain his seat?
Yeah, there really were. And as a matter of fact, there's a pretty interesting pattern out there on both sides. Members that were perceived of as vulnerable, mostly went no. And that was whether they were Democrat or Republican. That's a pretty good indicator that most politicians understood that this was a risky vote, no matter where they were on the political spectrum. But there were some really principled people out there. A guy like Joe Nolenberg in Michigan, who's in a very tough race, literally changed his vote because he thought it was so important for the state of Michigan, which is having a lot of economic turmoil, even more than the rest of the country. So there are some real profiles and courage out there. Joe was certainly one of them. But most vulnerables on both sides tried to stay in the no column and did.
And you also got Chris Shays up in Connecticut who was agonizing over his vote on this program.
Absolutely. And there's another guy that leads with a lot of courage. That's just Chris's nature. And, again, he voted yes on this. Yes, as I recall. So, again, a guy that showed a lot of guts and a lot of leadership. And I think that will actually rebound to his advantage. That's just who he is, and he's known to vote that way. He's certainly broken with his party plenty of times over the years. And Chris is very independent.
Well, did a no vote help some Republicans as you look at the polls in the week past?
In some places it probably did, although I think mostly it just kept them out of trouble. I'll just give you an example. In my district, we probably got 3,000 or 4,000 calls and emails on this, and they ran the initial batch. The first half ran literally 13-1 against it. Second half were still negative, but not that negative or as negative. So, again, that's something no member likes to go through, and you got to go home, as I did this last week, and basically explain your vote, tell people why perhaps you knew something that they didn't have a chance to know because the nature of the bill had changed very rapidly. But again, it's a high-risk vote. So the safe vote was to vote no and then hope the rescue plan passed as it eventually did. You're not going to get much criticism for that.
Although I suspect as you were home in your district, you also heard from people who had a chance to look at their 401k statements that probably arrived within the last 10 days. And I guess for some of them, it was a real wake-up call that this isn't so much about the banks as it is about their own personal fortunes.
Absolutely right. And I think the problem is, again, though, there's still confusion because once the package was passed on Friday, of course, we had a terrific week last week. So you got a lot of, gosh, you voted for it. It didn't make things better. And I tried to explain to my voters, we passed it on Friday. You really think things were going to happen dramatically by Monday? It's going to take a while. But there's no question. I think as this sort of grinds on, people do expect action as opposed to inaction out of the government. And if you can show you were willing to do that and do it decisively at a time when it wasn't popular, then over time, I think it might benefit. But again, it's a high-risk right. vote for a vulnerable member.
Well, Congressman, I think I've been pretty much Mr. Softy here on you, and so I think it's time to really turn the corner. How many seats are the Democrats going to take from the Republicans in Congress?
I stay away from the prediction game, but it's a good year for them. You know, again, it's winning a third presidential in a row is very difficult. Obviously, we've got a challenging war abroad. We've got a soft economy at home. This rescue package, which frankly, you know, the president probably deserves the most credit on because he's the one that put it out there at great expense to his party, I might add. You know, it's not those things put together don't create a pretty very good environment for you, and then you add open seats. So a good year to be a Democrat. However, I think we're going to do better than most people think. I think the presidential, frankly, is probably, you know, widened as far as it's going to, and I would expect the next 3 weeks it'll begin to narrow. And again, a lot of the battlegrounds that we're fighting in, regardless of how McCain does nationwide, are in areas that he is very likely right. to carry. So we've got good terrain. So
one quick last question. What seat is typical, if it goes Democrat, that's an indication of more of a debacle for you?
Well, you mentioned one of them in Chris Shays. That would be a very important one to watch. There's an open Republican seat in upstate New York, Tom Reynolds' seat in the Buffalo area, I think very important seat for us.
Great stuff to watch, and we'll have to leave it there. Oklahoma Representative Tom Cole, who's the chairman of the National Republican Congressional Committee, joining us from D.C. A lot to think about there. Headlines from Femi Okeh, First Draft of History.
Thanks very much, John. Just coming up to 28 minutes past the hour. Just getting this news flash in from Associated Press News. Diplomats say that North Korea has restored UN monitoring rights at its main atomic site. And just this weekend, North Korea was taken off the terror list in the United States. Meanwhile, as we get back to the markets, Asian markets welcome news of efforts by European nations to provide protection for their banks. Hong Kong's major index closed up 10%. European investors followed suit. The FTSE is up about 4%, and our markets will be opening in 1 minute from now. Meanwhile, investors on Wall Street appear to be thinking that what goes down must come back up. Dow futures are up with the markets are set to open. Yes, less than a minute from now. This just in, France will guarantee up to $435 billion of interbank loans to back up the crisis-hit financial sector. President Nicolas Sarkozy announced this today. The Mitsubishi investment in Morgan Stanley deal. The Japanese bank will purchase a $9 billion stake in the investment bank. And the deal was highly encouraged by the Bush administration. Morgan Stanley had been thought to be first in line to receive a government bailout. And also, the Bush administration says it's working out how to buy $700 billion worth of bad debt. Assistant Treasury Neil Kashkari announced today that they're consulting with law firms on how the government will take up ownership in banks.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home, auto, and life insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. We're talking about the campaign, and the 2008 presidential campaign certainly has some issues that resonate back into immediate history. But you remember The War Room, the 1992 movie about the Clinton campaign for the first term?
So let me tell you what's at stake in this election. Every time that somebody comes along that's got some ideas, a Democrat comes along, the Republicans come up here and they ambush him. That is standard procedure. And here comes Clinton. He comes to New Hampshire. People here hurting. They want hope. They want somebody with vision. He gives it to them. So what do Republicans do? They get together with their wedge issues and they knock it off. If they succeed this time, it's going to be every time. You are never going to get a presidential candidate.
That's James Carville giving a pep talk to members of the War Room back in the 1992 campaign. The movie The War Room certainly made legends of people like James Carville and George Stephanopoulos, who also became legends in their role in the Clinton administration, including Dee Dee Myers, who was Bill Clinton's former White House press secretary and who appeared in the original movie The War Room. Tonight, the Sundance Channel screened something called The Return of the War Room. Dee Dee Myers, in some ways, we've never left the War Room, correct?
Well, in some ways, that's true. I think the idea that, politics is a full contact sport is with us to stay. But in some ways, watching the War Room now, it seems very antiquated. You know, things moved fast. You have scenes where they're faxing clips of the Washington Post to the War Room in Little Rock, Arkansas, at, you know, O Dark 100 to get, you know, so people could wake up in Arkansas and see what was happening around the country. And, of course, all that's gone by the wayside and then some. And the speed with which the whole process moves. And, you know, we would sort of hit them on Tuesday and they'd hit us back Tuesday afternoon. And now, by that time, there's been six or seven exchanges, but, you know, before people have lunch.
Well, the technology certainly has changed, but the War Room really enshrined the back room campaign dealers as this kind of power elite who were where the center of the story was. It seems to me the candidate was more in the background after the War Room, and certainly cable news structures its coverage around kind of recreating the War Room, whether you've got, you know, Wolf Blitzer in the Situation Room or, you know, in Fox they have their own room. That's part of the legacy of the War Room, it seems to me.
I think that's right. In some ways, I think it's overblown. I think we've become an information culture that's almost obsessed with what goes on behind the scenes, and the War Room is certainly an example of that. I mean, what was happening in the War Room was, of course, important, and it was shaping a lot of what was happening out on the campaign trail. But there was still this other guy named Bill Clinton who was, as you say, out on the campaign trail every day talking to the American people, and what he was saying was getting covered somewhat too.
Actually, that's really interesting, because I remember I was pretty close to the filmmakers when they were making the War Room. They were terrified that they were getting no access to the candidate, that they had no movie, that in fact they didn't realize until they were in the edit room that the movie was in the War Room.
I think they felt like they were seeing some kind of a sideshow, and then they realized that they had these two larger-than-life characters in Carville and George Stephanopoulos, who around whom they could tell this whole story of the campaign in a different way. And I think you're right, it has changed the way people think about campaigns. I think the War Room was the beginning of a let's draw back the curtain and see what goes on behind, what's going on behind the candidate who's out there talking on the stump. And I think we've seen an increasing interest in the tactics and, the decisions that get made there and the strategies to hit back and how they're going to attack and counterattack and all that.
But maybe the curtain has been pulled in the sense that the War Room was sort of the last time we're going to get a candid moment behind the scenes anymore.
Yeah.
Everybody's like got it all scripted now.
That too, and you know, talking to James recently about it, you know, I'm not sure that he's sure why he said yes to allowing this film crew, and you know, D.A. Pennebaker and Chris Hedges are great filmmakers, but it a lot of things could have happened, right? And instead, you have sort of an interesting narrative of this campaign that was, well, if they hadn't won, I guess there would be no, the War Room movie might never have been made.
Well, it might have been Journeys with Bill, you know.
Yeah,
it
would have been something, you know, like a web feature 10 years later.
Right.
But, you know, things came together in a very interesting way. Their decision to let these filmmakers have the access, the fact that the campaign unfolded in this sort of unpredictable way and that Bill Clinton then won created it's a pretty compelling narrative of a particular point in time.
What's the update on the Sundance Channel tonight?
The update on the Sundance Channel is something that Penny and Chris have never done, which is because they usually do things in real time. What they do is they go back and they talk to a lot of people who were there in the War Room in the 92 campaign and just update them on their perceptions of that campaign, of how things are happening now, what's changed in their lives. And so, you know, I was on the road with Clinton most of the time in 92, so not in the War Room as every day. But you do see people, you know, James, and you see James Carville's wife, Mary Madeline, and their children, and how much their life has moved on, as have all of our lives that were part of that 92 campaign, and reflecting back on, you know, what it meant, and what it meant not only to us politically but personally. It was a turning point in almost everybody's life who was part of that campaign. So it's kind of a personal story as well as a political story.
Well, one of the moments from the film that airs tonight on Sundance shows that, you know, Carville in his element on his XM radio show every Friday, the 60-20 sports talk show that Carville does. Listen to this moment, which I think does speak to the personal transformation that took place to James Carville.
Cameras are the lifeblood of democracy. That's how people find out things in our democracy.
Oh, so it's people before the camera was invented never found out anything?
They had reporters.
There was no media prior to 1945?
They had media, and they would grandstand before that. They'd grandstand before the radio mics. And they'd grandstand before the print press.
It's James Carville slugging it out with Luke Russert over the issue of cameras and democracy and grandstanding. I mean, you know, Carville, I think sports talk radio is probably the perfect trajectory for James Carville on some level.
Well, James certainly knows a lot about grandstanding. I mean, you know, I mean, he is a performer, and I mean that as a compliment, who understands so much of public life, politics, sports is about the show. And, he can. That's an unfettered forum for him where he can go talk, say anything he wants about a subject he cares a lot about, which is sports. But I think it speaks to the P.T. Barnum in him. I mean, he can make anything interesting.
Any P.T. Barnum in you before we go?
I guess there's always a little. You don't become a press secretary, you know, if you don't like standing up there and, you know, listening to yourself talk. So a little bit. I guess I'm just not as good at it as James. He's made a whole, you know, he's become a celebrity that's so unique that, you know, people say, oh, yeah, that could be like Carville. It's like no, there isn't another Carville. You know, he's created his own particular universe. And there's a lot of
And he consults on political campaigns in Belarus, you know, I mean,
yeah,
all over the world.
Yeah, well, he sort of can't do it here. I mean, that's the one downside. I mean, on one hand, once you do something, a campaign like 92, you know you can never catch that lightning in a bottle again. On the other hand, he's become such a subject in and of himself that it's hard for him not to distract
he's
in
huge.
A smaller campaign.
Well, you're all huge. Dee Dee Myers, thanks so much for joining
thanks,
us. She's
John,
a CBS analyst, former press secretary in the Clinton White House, and one of the stars in the movie, the Sundance Channel, Return of the War Room. Follow-up to the 1992 The War Room. Thank you, Dee Dee.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry. So crisis schmisis. This is what President Bush is calling this whole mess.
The United States will take strong action in dealing with the current economic situation.
The president calls it a situation. He also referred to it as this deal last week. But what do you call it? Our listening friend Troy from North Dakota said he was tired of meltdown and crisis and suggested that we come up with some new words. And we have over 100 ideas. Here's what some of you came up with. Maria Beach wrote us to say by email that I propose we call this the deregulation debacle. Or if you want to point fingers, it could be W's deregulation debacle. Don't say that fast. Lots of you renamed the crisis in honor of your politicians.
Ronald Reagan's reward, Bush's legacy. Frank's folly, in honor of Barney Frank.
Some of you blamed greed.
Hi, this is Tom from Vernon, Vermont, and I think we could start calling this meltdown era perhaps the post-gluttony era.
PGS, post-greed syndrome.
Greed terrorism.
It's called class warfare.
That's a traditional Marxist speaking there. And then there were the metaphors, the complex metaphors. Mary Coco wrote in to call it the Enron of real estate. Many of you saw biblical allusions.
My grandmother was always looking for signs that the end of the world was near, and I think the little bit of grandmother in me would call this the apocalypse.
Cashocalypse, or my favorite, Economageddon.
The econolypse.
Econolypse. Can't put lipstick on those. You played with other disasters in history.
The financial fall of Icarus, or the financial Titanic.
Capitalism's Katrina.
Economic nuclear winter.
Or even disasters in your own homes.
What we have here is a backed up toilet.
Oh, that's pleasant. Some of you reimagined movies.
Hello, this is Rob Martin in Buffalo Valley, Oklahoma, and my idea is Nightmare on Wall Street.
Hi there. This financial meltdown just reminds me of that great movie, Deliverance.
And of course, there's just plain old feelings, just stuff that's related to the brain stem and nothing more. Those of glee.
I call it comic relief.
Those are people with 401ks that weren't affected, and then there were these folks.
I'm Marco from Oklahoma City, and this is how I refer to the present financial crisis.
No more calls. Perhaps we have a winner here. You can go to our website, thetakeaway.org, and vote on what new word or gesture or emotional outburst you would like to use in replacement for the synonyms meltdown and crisis you like best. So far this morning, the top three are number one, the age of economic reality, number two, reality redux, that's pretty good, and number three, civilization correction. Vote early, vote often. If you're dead, you can vote. You can call us with your new term to describe the market carnage at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Simply just pick up the phone, dial 877-8-MY-TAKE, and...
My new phrase for what we're the mess we're in is the 2008 Great Lemming Leap.
Maybe it should be called Goldman Takes It All. Goldman Sachs Takes It All.
Register at 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTAKE at thetakeaway.org. America responded to The Takeaway.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. Another look at the headlines with Femi Oke.
Thanks very much, John. 12 minutes to the top of the hour. The markets in the U.S. are finally headed north after a brutal week last week, and the Dow is up around about 400 points. That's a gain of about 4.6%. John, you can always chip in when you've got the latest there.
Well, you're about right.
Yeah, thank you very much. In Washington, the Treasury Department says it's moving fast to get the $700 billion rescue program started. The program's leader made his first public appearance today. Right now, the team is working on guidelines to buy bad assets, as well as the tricky legal details in taking partial bank ownership. Governments across Europe are making new moves today to jumpstart the credit market and prop up banks. So far, the markets seem to like the moves. European markets are up between 4 and 7%, and key indices closed higher across Asia. Firefighters are redeploying around Los Angeles for wildfire duty. They want to contain more of the inferno before gusting winds power up the fire. The flames have chased more than 1,000 people from their homes, and the wildfire is only about 20% contained. Now, it's 22 days until Election Day, and on the campaign trail, the VPs have been talking about taxes. Here's Sarah Palin. She was in St. Clairsville, Ohio.
John and I will bring tax relief to every American and to every business so that businesses can hire more people. That's how jobs are created.
And Joe Biden was in Scranton, Pennsylvania.
Instead of giving more tax breaks to companies that ship jobs overseas, as McCain proposes, we're going to take that money and give them tax breaks if they give jobs here in the United States of America.
Barack Obama is in Ohio today and is planning to deliver an economic rescue plan speech for the middle class. Meanwhile, John McCain will be in Virginia and North Carolina. And he said this morning, and I quote, "The national media has written us off. Senator Obama is measuring the drapes. My friends, we've got them just where we want them." End of quote.
I'm kind of worried. No Tina Fey today. Is she sick?
No, it was a repeat on Saturday.
Right, okay.
I'll get you something from
Thursday. Well, we've been talking about the campaign. Thank you, Femi. We've been
talking about
the campaign. They've got a barn burner race in Minnesota as a Senate race. Bob Collins, reporter from Minnesota Public Radio, joins us now. He's going to tell us the details in the race. Bob, it's between Republican incumbent Norm Coleman, challenger Al Franken, the Democrat, and independent Dean Barkley, who's sort of a Jesse Ventura-type candidate, right?
Yeah, that's right. And Dean Barkley is probably more connected to Jesse Ventura than a lot of people realize, because he's the one who claims credit for engineering Jesse Ventura's victory back in 1998.
Well, let's take a look at the three candidates one by one, and we'll start with the incumbent, Norm Coleman. It seems to me, on one level, Norm Coleman, who has the same problem that a lot of Republicans have, particularly in the Senate this year, they have to distance themselves from the president, and they have to project themselves as independents. In Minnesota, it seems to me that Norm Coleman has an easier task of that than maybe some other senators. So am I right or wrong?
Well, Norm Coleman has an easier time of it because he keeps falling back on the fact that he brought hockey back to Minnesota. And when it comes to politics, hockey will always trump President Bush.
Of course.
I think the question in Minnesota has been, is Norm Coleman a lapdog for President Bush, or is Norm Coleman a pragmatist, or is Norm Coleman just an opportunist? Al Franken has been hitting him on the fact that he voted with President Bush in the Senate, I think it was 92% of the time. That's the label he's been trying to pin on him. The reality of that, though, is Coleman has been hard to pin down on a lot of issues. He's changed on a lot of issues.
Well, here's an example of him. Here's an example of him not being pinned downable. He was asked one question about the bailout package at a recent debate, and here was his answer. Here's incumbent Norm Coleman.
I'm working with a bipartisan group. That's the only way to get it done. It's not about one side or the other. And we'll go through this a lot tonight, a lot of issues. But I'm the one person here who's actually done that, worked in a bipartisan way on a consistent basis.
He's not a Republican. He's a bipartisaner and whatever.
What I heard there, though, John, actually was him channeling Norm Coleman at a debate with Walter Mondale in the last year, days of the election in 2002. That quote that you basically heard, that strategy that you probably just heard, was what got him elected in 2002.
Right.
After Paul Wellstone was killed and Walter Mondale jumped on the ticket, at that last debate, a very close race, Mondale kept hammering Coleman. And Coleman's response to every question was, see, that's the kind of tone that we need to get rid of in Washington. We need bipartisanship. We need pragmatism. And last week, Norm Coleman dropped all of the negative campaign ads that he was running and went back to that strategy. So that's what you just heard.
His tried and true theme. Well, here, let's listen to Al Franken trying very hard not to get votes or to get laughs.
This is the exclamation point on this, the fiscal mismanagement of this administration. And Norm Coleman has stuck with this president every step of the way on his economic policy. This is the exclamation point on a disastrous administration.
There, Al Franken trying not to get laughs, but trying to inherit the legendary reputation and status of Democrat Paul Wellstone, who died during his last campaign, as you mentioned before. Do you think Franken really has a chance to attract the Wellstone voter?
He gets the Wellstone voter by default. The question is whether he gets the middle folks. There's no place else for the typical Minnesota Wellstone voter, at least the Twin Cities Wellstone voter, to go to but Al Franken. But like so many other races, of course, this one is one in the middle.
But Bob, it seems
Franken has been trying. Yeah,
it seems like Franken's problem is that Wellstone, who was a low percentage shot when he first ran, ended by being a real passionate liberal's liberal. And I just wonder if Al Franken can really gin up the passion. Sure, he gets the default votes, but can he really gin up the passion that Paul Wellstone did so well?
He'll try to do it, and has tried to do it on the strength of the war. Keep in mind, Wellstone, his legacy, of course, is Keynes, but he, I think one of the things that was happening when he was killed was he was still turning off some of those very passionate Wellstone voters, mostly on the issue of gay marriage, and then there was the question of him going back on his promise not to run for another term. Again, what Frank is trying to do is get that voter, get that crowd based solely on the issue of the war in Iraq. But what Coleman's trying to do, since Franken is against the bailout bill, which had mental health parity, which was a Wellstone initiative in it, is Coleman's turning around to that same voter and says, look, Franken was against the bailout bill, so Franken was against mental health parity.
And in the middle of that argument, of course, is Dean Barkley, the inheritor of Jesse Ventura's reputation, whatever that is. And here is Barkley campaigning.
If Willie Nelson can run around in this country on vegetable oil in his bus, we've got the know-how. We've got the entrepreneurs out there.
I mean, he really is the key to this race, right?
Yes, and I think what happens historically in Minnesota to an independent candidate whose name is not Jesse Ventura is they put Republicans in office. That's what's happened in the past. That's from the first debate, which was last week. I would say Barkley won that race because he adhered to the law of politics, which is the candidate least likely to get elected tends to be the most outspoken and honest sounding. He came out Saturday night, though, and continued to hammer that theme. And I think he came off just a little too angry, which was a label, by the way, that Coleman's tried to pin on Franken, and a little too negative. And so he might have overplayed his hand a little bit. I think you may see a little shift back from maybe some of the Barkley votes to Franken.
Last question, and quickly, what are the numbers at this point? Any insights?
Well, the polls are crazy on this. There was a poll that showed Coleman up 10. There was another poll in the same weekend that showed Franken up 10. But some of the other polls seem to suggest that Franken up slightly. Coleman pulling his negative ads probably tells me that there's some internal polling that shows Franken's running very strong.
Wow. Well, crazy race. Very interesting. Bob Collins, thanks so much for joining us.
Good to be with you, John.
Bob Collins, reporter for Minnesota Public Radio. We're always on at The Takeaway. We've been asking what your word for the economic crisis is, and you said...
I think I would call this situation the stock-copalypse.
What's your word for the crisis? 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytakeatthetakeaway.org. And what's your takeaway for the day?
You don't become a press secretary, you know, if you don't like standing up there and, you know, listening to yourself talk.
Dee Dee Myers listening to herself talk. I was listening to CBS analyst, former press secretary for the Clinton White House. You can vote for your favorite new words for the economic crisis on our website. Right now, the number one out of almost 200 choices is the age of economic reality. But you can vote for those that haven't made the top three by going to mytakeatthetakeaway.org. Greedlash, the decline of the American financial empire, that's one. And anything about the election is also at our website. Look for America's Exit Poll coming soon to a takeaway near you. I'm John Hockenberry.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.